Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
We're in the midst, I believe, of a burgeoning food movement where people are going to farmers markets more regularly. They're supporting community-supported agriculture programs. And the more that that happens, the more we're going to see factory farms pushed away.
That's Gene Bauer, president and co-founder of Farm Sanctuary. He stops by the Earth Eats studios to talk about how his organization is working to improve living conditions for farm animals. Meat eaters will enjoy our two recipes today. Chef Daniel Orr is preparing chili and a stew. The meat of choice in those dishes is bison, and he visits a local farm to see how those animals live. Before that, Harvest Public Media reports that Roundup-resistant weeds are changing the game for farmers. That's all coming up today on Earth Eats. With a look at the food news making headlines, here's Mia Bartlow. Welcome.
Hi there. Ahead of the impending fiscal cliff, the still incomplete farm bill finds itself amidst a very different political environment than that of this past summer. Chairs of the House and Senate Agriculture Committees remain adamant that the bill is at the top of legislators' priority lists. Colin Peterson, ranking Democrat on the House Agriculture Committee, promised to fight if Republicans pushed to pass a simple one-year extension of the current farm bill rather than a full five-year package. Republican Pat Roberts has agreed, saying, quote, "There are an awful lot of farmers and ranchers and their lenders out there now who are sort of in financial purgatory," unquote. Some experts say the best possible outcome would be for the House to vote on the draft bill passed by its Agriculture Committee earlier this year, and then for a bicameral committee to develop a final hybrid version with the bill already passed by the Senate. Unfortunately, there are only a few weeks remaining in the current congressional session. Because legislation does not carry over from one Congress to the next, legislators would have to start from scratch in the next session if the bill isn't finalized. Some 3,500 dairy farmers have been demonstrating outside the European Parliament in Brussels since Monday. The European Milk Board, which orchestrated the protest, said that current pricing and quota policies are driving small farmers out of business. While tractors blocked traffic along major roadways, some farmers used high-pressure hoses to spray milk at the Parliament building and at police officers. The European dairy industry suffered a crisis in 2009, which has led 157,000 dairy farms to go out of business. 31% of the world's milk is produced in the European Union. And new data from Consumer Reports shows troubling levels of harmful bacteria in pork. This bacteria may be resistant to commonly prescribed antibiotics for humans. Pigs kept in tight quarters are often given continuous low doses of antibiotics to fend off disease. This causes bacteria to mutate, making it resistant to antibiotics, and potentially causes harmful bacteria to remain in the meat. To avoid foodborne illness, ensure meat is cooked to an internal temperature of 145 degrees for pork chops and 160 degrees for ground pork. For more news like this throughout the day, follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search for Earth Eats.
And connect with us on our website to read archived news stories. We're at eartheats.org. Mia Bartlow, always a pleasure.
You got it.
Farmers and weeds are in a constant competition. It's a race that swings back and forth. But when the herbicide called Roundup came along, it gave farmers a clear edge. Now weeds are beginning to catch up, and farmers are using more chemicals to try to stay ahead. Grant Gerlach of Harvest Public Media has more on how Roundup-resistant weeds are changing the game.
When genetically engineered Roundup-ready crops came on the scene in the mid-1990s, they made weed control a relative walk in the park. The idea was you spray your fields with one herbicide, and the crops live, but the weeds die. By 2011, more than 90% of soybeans and cotton and more than 70% of corn were planted with Roundup-ready seeds.
It was so simple and forgiving and flexible, and there weren't a lot of risk involved with it, and it worked really well.
That's Chuck Benbrook, a researcher with the Center for Sustaining Agriculture and Natural Resources at Washington State University. Benbrook says in the early years, farmers were able to use less herbicide overall by using more Roundup. But in a new study, Benbrook finds that changed as weeds started to adapt.
Well, the so-called herbicide-tolerant, Roundup-ready corn, soybeans, and cotton has driven up herbicide use by about 527 million pounds over this 16-year period.
That's a total increase of about 7% from 1996 to 2011. Benbrook says some of the largest jumps have come in just the last few years, as more farmers begin to battle Roundup-resistant weeds. We called Monsanto about the study. That's the company that makes Roundup, but we didn't hear back. Think of how doctors overprescribed antibiotics and now face drug-resistant infections. Benbrook says farmers relied too heavily on Roundup, and now it isn't killing weeds the way it used to. Farmers like Ron Pavelka near Hastings in central Nebraska are noticing.
I'm in the combine right now cutting soybeans.
Pavelka drives his combine to the top of a hill to get a better connection on his cell phone. He farms corn and soybeans and is only a few days away from finishing the harvest. Most of Pavelka's crops are Roundup ready and have been since the seeds became available.
In the beginning, before there were Roundup ready soybeans, weed control in soybeans was always an issue for producers. There were a lot of different options, but nothing that really worked as well as a Roundup application.
But these days, Pavelka, who's also on the Nebraska Soybean Board, says Roundup alone isn't working. Like many farmers, Pavelka is adding other herbicides to the mix to finish the job. He also started spraying fields in the fall to help keep weeds down. Still, a few are slipping through the cracks.
Well, in our area, the number one issue would be with a weed called mare's tail. And it kind of has a really slender leaf, so it's kind of an issue getting the proper amount of herbicide on that plant, and it's just kind of a tough, woody old thing.
Across the Midwest, a handful of weeds are forming pockets of resistance.
For Iowa and most of our surrounding states, water hemp is the number one weed.
Bob Hartzler is an agronomist and weed specialist at Iowa State University.
A giant ragweed is another native plant that's adapting to corn and soybeans. It's the number one problem in states like Ohio, Indiana.
Hartzler says farmers can manage resistant weeds for now by going back to some of the chemicals they used before Roundup came along. But he says that does not address a fundamental problem. Plants like water hemp, mare's tail, and giant ragweed have become very good at adapting to whichever herbicides farmers choose. And Hartzler says conventional farming plays to their comfort zone.
I like to say that you couldn't sit down and design a better system for weeds to adapt to. We're relying almost entirely on herbicides. We're growing two crops with the same life cycle, and weeds just thrive under that system.
One thing is for sure, weeds will continue to adapt. The question is what farmers will do to stay one step ahead. I'm Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. Last month, the group Mercy for Animals released a video detailing turkey abuse at several butterball plants in North Carolina. The footage shows workers kicking and throwing birds around the plant. One employee also notes that there are maggots crawling all over the birds. It's conditions like these that organizations like Farm Sanctuary fight against through advocacy, education, and animal rescue. In fact, with their locations in New York and California, Farm Sanctuary is the largest rescue and refuge network for farm animals in North America. Gene Bauer is the president and co-founder of Farm Sanctuary. A vegan since 1985, Bauer has been called the conscience of the food movement.
Farm animals, like all animals, have feelings. They have deep emotional lives. They have complex cognitive abilities. They're not that different than cats or dogs, and they deserve to be treated with respect and compassion.
He stopped by the Earth Eats studios in Bloomington, Indiana on a recent speaking tour.
So how did a Hollywood, California kid get into farm animals?
Well, I grew up wanting to make a positive difference in the world is the bottom line. And as I, you know, as time went, I learned about different things. I got involved with human rights organizations and environmental organizations. Then I learned about factory farming and the many problems caused by it. And it was an issue that was not getting a lot of attention in the mid-1980s. So co-founded Farm Sanctuary, and I've been doing this work ever since.
I'm reluctant to ask this next question because I know what you're going to say. Tell me some of the things you've seen when you visited factory farms.
Well, you know, I've found living animals literally thrown in trash cans or left on piles of dead animals. And whenever possible, we rescue those animals. I've also seen animals put in cages, in crates, and packed so tightly they can't even turn around or stretch their limbs or move for their whole lives. These animals sometimes have bruises and abrasions on their bodies from constantly scraping against the metal bars of their enclosures. I found animals too sick to walk being dragged onto trucks and taken to slaughter to be used for human food. Sometimes they're pushed with forklifts, dragged with chains. The bottom line is that these are living, feeling animals, and they deserve better. They deserve to be treated with compassion and respect. And how we treat other animals says an awful lot about us. And at the end of the day, we should make food choices that we can feel good about instead of saying, don't tell me, I don't want to know, which is too often what people say when they hear about factory farming or when the topic comes up. Also, it's important to recognize that we can live and do very well by eating only plant foods and not eating any meat, milk, or eggs.
Well, then the next logical question is, in your ideal world, would we all be vegetarians or vegans?
In an ideal world, we would not be killing and eating other animals, in my ideal world. But you know, each person has their own opinion and may have another vision of what the ideal world looks like. But from my standpoint, killing is an inherently violent act, and it's one that we don't need to engage in. And for me, being vegan is a lifestyle. It's almost like a religion. So I would love other people to share my lifestyle and my religion just because I think it makes a lot of sense. But I also recognize that everybody has their own opinion. What I would encourage, though, is that people make decisions about their food that are aligned with their own values and aligned with their own interests.
About killing animals for food. So we're a local sustainable food show, and so we talk to a lot of farmers, and this one particular farmer is named Jim Fiedler. He raises certified organic grass-fed free-range cows, pigs, and chickens in southern Indiana on the Ohio River. And he said, quote, "We identify our pigs as happy pigs. They have one bad day, and I wish that's all I had in my life." What would you say to that?
Well, I would say that it's good that these animals are being given some decency in their lives, unlike most animals that are raised for food. But I would also say that in many cases, you have animals that are raised and slaughtered, and they're being marketed in a way that sounds a lot better than it is. And I cannot speak to this particular situation, but you know, the term free range, for example, makes people believe that these animals are outdoors free ranging. But free range only requires that animals be given access to the outdoors, and that's not defined. So you often have animals raised in warehouses with a small door that goes to a crummy little paddock, and that's technically free range when it doesn't really meet what most people would assume free range meets. So I think if people are going to buy animal foods, it's important to get to know the farmers, ideally go to farmers markets, maybe even visit the farms to see what's happening, because a lot of times these labels are very misleading.
What's happening in states like Iowa and Utah most recently, they have laws on the books now restricting taking photos and making videos in factory farms. They're calling them ag gag laws. So I wonder, from an activist point of view, what this means for the work that you do.
Well, I think it's very telling that this is an industry that is so concerned about the way its animals are treated that it's making it illegal to take pictures and to show people how these animals are being treated. And that speaks to the fact that these conditions are outside the bounds of acceptable conduct in our society. And I am not happy that the industry is pushing for and passing laws to make it illegal to videotape and show pictures of these animals. But I ultimately believe that the truth has a way of coming out. People are going to learn about what happens on factory farms. So I'm confident that citizens will continue to dig more into these issues as they've started to do and will ultimately, you know, reject factory farming, and change is going to have to happen.
Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you very much.
Read more from my conversation with Jean Bauer on our website, eartheats.org. Coming up,
my husband likes buffalo a lot, took me to a buffalo farm on her honeymoon and bought me a buffalo for my birthday.
That's Kathleen Cruz of Buffalo Run Farm. They've been farming those big animals in southern Indiana for 13 years. Chef Daniel Orr pays her a visit up next.
Blood and breath, hoof and hide. The long guns came and the bison died. Running with the wind against the time, you are an ancient one. Bison, 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 you are the native son.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh local organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop, and Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
All right. So we're at Buffalo Run, and that's located in what part of Indiana?
We're in Lincoln City, Indiana, which is kind of halfway between Louisville, Kentucky and Evansville, Indiana. And we're also located in Abraham Lincoln's boyhood home in Lincoln City.
Oh, that's so much fun.
Chef Daniel Orr went on a field trip to visit Kathleen Cruz at Buffalo Run Farm. Bison, also commonly called American buffalo, is called America's original red meat because it was the main protein source for Plains Indians until the animals were nearly hunted to extinction in the late 19th century. These days, in addition to wild bison herds in national parks and nature preserves, farms are keeping bison as livestock. According to the website eatbisonmeat.com, Indiana boasts 34 bison farms. In addition to raising bison, they have Devon cattle at Buffalo Run Farm. That's a heritage breed of cows that's known for the rich milk used in Devonshire cream.
And they were with the first colonial settlers that came to America. And what's really neat about them, they have a distinct look. They are kind of what I call red.
Uh-huh.
And they have horns. The males and the females have horns, just like the buffalo. They can be dairy animals, beef animals, or draft animals.
So draft meaning that they can be work animals.
That's exactly right. So when we have our first calves, we've only been in this for about a year, and so the young ones, then we will touch them and we will work with them and hopefully be able to pull a plow or a small cart,
right,
and teach them to be oxen.
Well, they look very perky and very muscular and an interesting cow. I've not seen one quite like that. Now, do you want to tell me a little bit about the pigs that you're raising, the heritage pigs?
Okay. Also, first animals that came to colonial America, that's what makes them heritage animals. They are called belted Wessex.
Okay.
And they are black with a white belt on them. And they're really cool. And we've gone through our first litter, our first piglets. And so our sow is now bred again, and so we'll be having our second set of piglets. So.
Right, right. I saw that you had ostriches at one point. Do you still have ostriches?
We do not have any right now. We actually recently started looking again. They don't get along with the buffalo very well. They're not very smart. They're the only animal in the world whose brain is smaller than their eyeball. And so once in a while, one would challenge a buffalo, and the buffalo wins.
Yeah.
And then they also don't like to be confined, and so they do fine in hot weather because they're used to that. And they also do okay in really cold weather. But when we get the sleet and the freezing rain, it freezes their feathers, and they can't keep themselves warm, and they would not stay in a shelter. And so we lost a few that way.
All right. Well, we see the bison kind of coming in here as a small herd. Are there any challenges in raising bison that make them different from cows?
Well, they, you don't normally use a cattle prod. They go where they want to go, when they want to go, because they're so big and they're very agile, very athletic. They can run 35 miles an hour. They can jump a 6-foot fence if they want to. What we have learned, though, is if you run electric about nose high on them, they'll sting their nose when they try to get the grass on the other side of the fence that's always greener.
Right.
And then they think the whole thing is hot, and they think, maybe I won't do that. And so generally, they'll stay back from a fence if you run electric on it. They are otherwise pretty easy to deal with as long as they have a water source and as long as they have plenty of grass.
So we're going to... If they want a taste of the bison, do you have that available at the farm?
Yes, we do sell buffalo burgers. You can purchase the buffalo meat and take it home and put it in your favorite recipe.
All right, guys, are you ready to try this burger? You're on radio now. Oh! All right, let's try it. Let's see how it tastes. All right, well, it has a really nice sweet flavor. I think the boys are going to love to have some ketchup on it. Mm-mm-mm.
See photos of the farm on our website, eartheats.org. Chef Orr is back in his natural habitat, the kitchen. The first recipe he's making today uses bison meat in a chili.
Today we are going to do another wonderful winter dish. And this you can make ahead and eat for several days. You could make a sloppy joe with it for one meal. You could put it on top of a hot dog for another meal. Or you could just have a bowl of chili and serve it with one of my grandmother's biscuits, some sour cream, and some scallions. So you can make a big batch of this. It does freeze well, too. All right, so just a little bit of olive oil. You could use any type of fat that you like. We're going to add the bison. And you can see the bison's a real rich, dark, almost burgundy-looking meat. It's very, very lean. It's actually leaner than turkey. Just going to break that up. Okay, and we're going to just start adding the other ingredients. It's a really simple recipe. It's just about tossing all this stuff in. We're going to add our red and green peppers. We've got some diced carrots. Lots of onions. You can't have too many onions in a chili. A couple cups of fresh diced tomatoes. About 2 cups of canned tomatoes. We've got 1/4 cup of sorghum. Now, sorghum is a type of molasses that we use. It comes from a grain that's kind of close to a corn. It has a nice sweet flavor, kind of like molasses. Do you want to try it?
Let's give this a shot. Ooh, that's so rich.
I'm going to toss all this together.
I can smell the onions already.
And at Earth Eats, where there are onions, what usually follows?
Garlic, absolutely. Of course.
So we got our garlic. Got probably a couple tablespoons of garlic. Okay, and now we're going to add our seasonings. We've got my favorite sweet seasons, which is that kind of Chinese five-spice flavor. We've got some ground cumin, some cayenne pepper, which is going to give it a little bit of a bite, and a little bit of cinnamon. Okay, and we just got a couple more ingredients. This is where the Columbus Cowboy comes in. This is the some old coffee. So when you have leftover coffee, don't throw it away. What I like to do is to use it in chilies and stews. Red Eye gravy actually has coffee in it, so it's a nice gravy you can make out of coffee. The other thing you can do is you can pour it into an ice cube tray, and then if you like iced coffee, instead of putting regular ice in it, you can use frozen coffee ice cubes.
Oh, here comes the pumpkin.
Here comes the pumpkin, and what this is going to do is add a touch of sweetness as well as give it a nice, rich, creamy viscosity to the chili. And the last ingredient is the lentils. We're just going to top this off with enough water to moisten it all up. Again, we don't want to add too much and have to boil it down for a long time. The lentils are going to absorb some of the water. So we're going to let this come to a full boil, reduce the temperature to a simmer, and then let it simmer for about a half an hour or until it gets nice and thick and chili-like.
Bison is a good substitute for beef, since it's lower in both fat and cholesterol. But for our final recipe today, we're going to use some beef brisket anyway. You do want to use one of the tougher cuts or varieties of meat, because we're going to stew it for 2 to 3 hours.
So, we've got these nice big hunks of meat. You want them about an inch, and a half inch to an inch cubes. I'm going to season this. I've got some of my
au poivre blend, which is a mixture of five peppercorns, fennel seeds, and coriander seeds. But you could use just cracked black pepper or spices that you like. I'm going to season this with a little bit of salt. Okay, and what that's going to do is it's going to start bringing the moisture to the surface of the meat. And then we're going to toss it in the flour. And this is going to enrobe the beef, and it's going to give it a really nice color when we sear it. Also, the flour, as it cooks, it's going to thicken the liquids that we add later, and that's what's going to give your stew that nice, rich viscosity. Okay, we have a little bit of oil. Okay, I'm just adding this. You can hear it sizzling. This would be almost like making a bœuf bourguignon, which is a classic French beef stew that Julia Child was very famous for. I think she had like a four-page recipe for it.
That's right, that's right.
Just shake it around a little bit. We don't want anything to burn. We're also letting that flour cook, which you don't want to have a real kind of pasty-tasting stew, which if you just threw some white flour in there, what we're doing is we're actually making a roux, and it's equal parts of flour and fat, usually butter. But we're making that just in the pan with this, using the meat fats, the olive oil that I put in there, and the flour that we rolled the meat in. You want to get that nice, what they call in French, a fond, and that's what the brown color is giving you. It's giving you that kind of rich, nutty, toasty flavor that you want. And give it the time. This is one of the most important parts of making a stew, is this browning and this caramelization. Okay, once we have the meat all nicely caramelized, we're going to add our nice big chunky onions.
We got the carrots.
Okay, we've got some nice big chunky carrots. Again, rustic cut. And you can use whatever you have. You could use all different kinds of root vegetables, celery root, parsnip, turnips would be great in here. I'm going to put a couple orange peels in there. It's going to give it a kind of a unique flavor. And you do want to salt your stew at the beginning because you want that salt to be absorbed into the meat. Okay, I'm going to throw in a couple bay leaves and, of course, some whole cloves of garlic.
Your favorite.
Okay, now we're going to add some red wine. Okay, and we're going to cook this until the red wine evaporates. And then we're just going to top it with a little bit of water just so everything kind of bobs in there like they're treading water. And then stew it until it's tender, about 2 hours, 2.5 hours.
Through the magic of radio, we fast forward. It's got a nice thick consistency to it.
Nice, and you see the big chunks of beef in there, the potatoes, which we added in the last half an hour cooking. And the onions and everything, it's all kind of melted down to a nice sauce. All right, so we're going to take some buttered noodles, whatever you have. You could use spaghetti or egg noodles. Okay, we're going to dish out some of that nice chunky stew. Perfect thing for a cold, blustery winter afternoon.
This is a great recipe to make for a group of friends. It yields about 1.5 gallons of stew. Find all the recipes from today's episode on our website. Read interviews and news updates, and subscribe to our weekly podcast while you're there. It's all at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Aabon Binder, Kathleen Cruz, Sarah Gordon, Liz Leslie, Chef Daniel Orr, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop, and Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga, more at touchstonewellness.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
And thank you for listening. Till next week, happy eating. I'm Annie Corrigan.